Good morning. Now, I know some people don't like to mix faith and politics, but there's just absolutely no way around it this morning. The Book of Esther is extremely political. The whole story literally revolves around a king and his queens. The story is filled with public policy announcements. There is an assassination plot. There are political rivalries throughout the story. So to do this book justice, I have to go there. And that's before acknowledging that the heart of the gospel, the good news that we proclaim about Jesus Christ, is that Jesus is king. Jesus is king and Lord over the heavens and the earth. That what Jesus accomplished by entering into Jerusalem on a donkey, by suffering and dying on a Roman cross, by being raised from the dead, by being ascended, by ascending to the right hand of the Father, that in that story we hear the inauguration of Jesus's kingdom and of the king. And so our faith in Jesus is a political faith that makes claims about all of the other kingdoms of the earth. What I think most people mean when they say that church or faith shouldn't be political is that it shouldn't be partisan. Partisan meaning aligning with the partisan politics of our culture and our day. And so I want to assure you that as political as this is going to get this morning, I have worked really hard to make sure it is not partisan. And so would you stay with me? Would you trust me as we move forward into Esther this morning? With that disclaimer out of the way, I want to help us understand the context for this morning's passage by looking at two of our own recent presidential elections. I want to consider for a few minutes what happened in our country following the elections of both Barack Obama and Donald Trump. When Barack Obama was elected president of the United States, two things happened. First, almost simultaneously, there were Americans weeping with sheer joy. At the same time, there were others who went into a panicked frenzy. For some in our country, Obama's election was a good thing. For others, it was not. For some who didn't like or who were afraid of Obama's election, for some, race was an issue. For others, it was his progressive policies and his party. Conservative media outlets began what would be 8 years of intense outrage filled with accusations and fear-mongering. There were even some Christians who would call Obama the Antichrist and others still who speculated that we wouldn't survive his presidency. Now consider the election of Donald Trump. Two things happened almost simultaneously. Some Americans wept with sheer joy at his election, and others went into a panicked frenzy. Sound familiar? Since it wasn't that long ago, you are probably aware that the reaction against Trump has been strong and persistent, not only from liberals, but even conservatives who don't feel Trump represents their conservatism. The opposition to him has been loud and persistent, filled with accusations and fear-mongering. Some Christians have called Trump the devil, and others have speculated that we won't survive this presidency. I'm not interested this morning and whether people were right or wrong to react to either of these elections the way that they did. What I want to point out is that both elections faced similar reactions. and that the reactions to both were rooted in the same general sense of gain or of loss. People were either overjoyed if they felt that that election gave them political control or power or position. Joy is the experience of those who believe that the country belongs to them and they are secure in it. On the other hand, people were panicked and anxious if they felt that this election, either election, took from them something that was theirs. Fear is the experience that comes with losing political control or power or privilege. Now, we know that not everyone felt one of these two emotions in their extremes, but each election saw these two extremes, and perhaps far too often, by followers of Jesus. And yet, a careful look at Jesus shows him refusing to react. No matter which group tried to provoke him, no matter which group confronted his political good news, the good news of his kingdom, with their political realities. Decades ago, Edwin Friedman diagnosed America as being chronically anxious, an anxiety that he said could be seen in our constant reactivity to each other. He described us as being people who feel like we're always under threat or risk, or at risk of loss or of losing what we have. For Friedman, even when people are excited, joyful about the results of the election that went their way, there's this underlying anxiety. There's this sense that this victory is temporary and that there are people out there working to take it away, that loss is just around the corner. And so we worry, we're anxious, and we react to anything that might be a threat. This was decades ago that he diagnosed us as reactive and anxious. Friedman had no idea just how reactive and anxious we would become. And it is this anxious reactivity that has been on my mind as I've been reading Esther along with you, as I've been listening to friends online, as I've been reading the news, and as I've been praying. This anxious reactivity has me fascinated with Mordecai. Someone who seems capable of maintaining a non-anxious presence in the world. For those of you unfamiliar with the book of Esther, Mordecai is one of the main characters. And let me just give you an example of what makes Mordecai just pop off the pages for me. So in chapter 2, starting in verse 21, if you have your Bibles, follow along with me. Starting in verse 21, we read, "In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Xerxes. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." Mordecai saves the king's life. Saving anyone's life, like, would be a big deal, right? But if you remember anything from last week, you know that King Xerxes is not a good king. Xerxes is largely absent as a leader over his people. He spends nearly a quarter of his early reign throwing one long party. Xerxes just lives to excess, and he invites his citizens to indulge in whatever they desire as well. Xerxes is impulsive, and he has thin skin, And his public policies are often knee-jerk reactions to personal insults. Xerxes, on top of all of that, when it comes to actual policy, is the anti-family values candidate. He had his own child separation policy before American politicians even dreamed it up. But Xerxes didn't just keep his separated children in cages. No. He gathered young unmarried girls together, taking them from their families into his harem, and he used them in his search for pleasure. This is where Mordecai comes into the picture. Mordecai is a foreigner. His family was exiled to this place a long time ago. We get hints throughout the text that Mordecai's people are not especially liked here. Mordecai has never had any say over who his king would be. And Mordecai has never had any influence over public policy. Xerxes and Mordecai are complete political opposites. One has all of the political power and one has none. On top of all of this, the young woman named Esther that Mordecai took into his home as his own daughter, the young woman Mordecai raised when her parents died, was one of the women taken by the king and forced into his harem. There is nothing about this place where Mordecai lives that is home to him. Mordecai is a long way from some place that he might consider safe. And even the little bit of family that he has left has now been taken away by the king. And yet, rather than fight back, rather than react, rather than anxiously trying to get back what was lost or casting blame, rather than reactively getting back at Xerxes, Mordecai acts with patience and virtue. He is a non-anxious presence in the world. Just sit with this for a second. This king, Mordecai's political enemy, King Xerxes, is saved by Mordecai on purpose. Could you do it? Are you sure? He didn't have to, but he did it. And when he did it, he received no recognition for it. Because, of course, King Xerxes likes to show off what he's done and conveniently forgets to acknowledge anyone else. Just as an aside, when the king finally realizes that he should probably do something for Mordecai, years later, he's actually forgotten all about it. And he doesn't even know how to honor someone. So he actually has to ask someone else for advice on how to honor another person. It's amazing. But Mordecai never seeks any honor. He never seeks recognition for what he's done. Even if it could have changed his political position in Persia, he's not looking to move politically. Mordecai's act to save Xerxes is just one of several in Mordecai's story that should strike us as so strange when we compare it to the politics of our day. The story also reveals something important to us about Mordecai's sense of place. Mordecai knows who he is, and he understands that he is not at home. And so, to a certain degree, Mordecai doesn't live with the illusion that he has any control beyond his own life and his own family. Mordecai is able to accept what is. He lives under the reign of a pagan king who is not particularly moral, who is not particularly trustworthy. Mordecai doesn't imagine that he has some control over or power to change the world ruled by Xerxes, which means he then doesn't get anxious when the world is out of his control, because it is always out of his control. There's no need to react when things don't go his way, because they never go his way. Or at least Mordecai lives with the assumption that things probably aren't going to go his way. Maybe some of you are familiar with a prayer that's popular in recovery groups. It's so powerful. It's known as the Serenity Prayer often. And it goes like this: Lord, give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I can picture Mordecai praying this prayer every day, not only because Mordecai accepts the things that he cannot change, but because he also has the courage to change the things that he can. One of the things that amazes me about Mordecai is his decision to raise Esther. Look at chapter 2, verse 7 with me. We read, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. I want to point out an awkward biblical reality. Esther is described as having a beautiful figure and lovely to look at. The daughter of Mordecai's uncle, Esther, was Mordecai's cousin. In another setting, at another time, in another context, Esther might have been the ideal wife for someone like Mordecai. In ancient biblical times, cousins were often seen as ideal marriage partners. And so consider this. There are two people with needs in this story. A good Jewish man needed to marry a good Jewish woman so that they could be fruitful and multiply and fulfill God's commandment for them in the world. At the same time, orphans needed good Jewish men and women to adopt them and raise them as their own. Mordecai could have justified marrying Esther as a way of taking her in. It wouldn't be the first time it had been done. But in a way that very much reminds me of Jesus, Mordecai gives up his rights, gives up his interests, maybe even his desires or passions. Maybe this is why we're told how attractive she is in this moment. And he does this in order to serve, to bless, to give life to someone else. Isn't it incredible? He refuses to take advantage of someone else's need to meet his own. In our anxiety, we often fear that no one else will take care of our need or our needs. And so we hoard toilet paper or whatever else it is that we think is scarce in the world. But when we pray to the God who gives us today our daily bread, we can entrust our needs to God and be used by God to meet the needs of others. Mordecai stands as a powerful contrast to Xerxes in this way, because Xerxes does what he feels like doing, taking all of the young women for himself, trying them all out. Mordecai has only one young woman, and he refuses to take even her. Mordecai's aunt and uncle die, and he sees an orphan whose life could be changed forever. And Mordecai has the courage to change what he can. This is so beautiful and also so brutal. It's brutal because when you read this story, it almost feels like he raises Esther just for King Xerxes to take. The story reminds us that we live in a sinful world, a world where sin is still present and powerful. And so even after Mordecai rescues Esther from a life of poverty and oppression, which is what orphanhood certainly meant, we discover that he can't rescue her from every trouble. That there are powers beyond Mordecai's control. He has the power to change Esther's life, but only to a degree. Yet, still, even when Esther has been taken into the king's harem, we don't see Mordecai anxious. There's no panic from him. There's no reaction. There is, again, just patience and virtue. And he offers this non-anxious presence for the world and also for Esther. Verse 11 tells us that every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Mordecai continues to do what he can and accept what he cannot. Mordecai gets it. He is not at home in Persia. And so he doesn't imagine that he has some control over or power to change the politics of his world. Which also means he isn't anxious when the world is out of his control because he just assumes the world will always be out of his control. I hope that I can be really direct here. I think this is the thing that we may need to get out of the book of Esther. You and I are tempted every single day to believe that this place, the United States, is our home. Since we were kids, we were told that America was different and better. We have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. We get to vote. We have power. We get to elect our people. We have a voice. And we're taught from an early age to put our hand on our heart and to pledge our allegiance, our loyalty, our lives to this country. And we're given passports, and we're given rights, and over time, all of these things cause us to forget who we are. We forget where we are from. We settle in, and we get comfortable, and we take hold of this place, and we cling to it, and we fight for it. And so we are constantly anxious, afraid of what we might lose, afraid of what we've already lost. But it is all a lie. Because what God has given to us, no one can take away from us. This is what Mordecai shows us in this book. Look at how we're introduced to him. Esther chapter 2, verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Mordecai has probably never seen Jerusalem in his life. It's been over 100 years at this point since his family lived in the Promised Land, and it is a long way away. And yet, this continues to be at the core of his identity. He is a Jew. Part of the great family descended from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and who claimed together Yahweh as their one true God. Even within the Jewish people, Mordecai is part of a distinct tribe, the Benjaminites. And within that tribe, he's a part of Jair's clan and Shammai's extended family and Kish's immediate family. And with each of these names, there are stories and more stories linking Mordecai to a people and to a God. But there is a reason why Mordecai is not in Jerusalem and why he is instead in Susa. And three times in the same sentence, we hear the phrase carried away. The Hebrew word behind this phrase is the word often translated as exile or exiled. Mordecai's family was exiled from Jerusalem, their home. They were taken among the captives, exiled with King Jeconiah. They were the ones Nebuchadnezzar exiled. Three times. This isn't an accident. The Jews were deeply affected by this event. It defined them and gave them a sense of their place in the world. They were an exiled people. In fact, you've heard me say before that there are two singular events in the First Testament that everything else revolves around. Every text, every word points either forward or backward to the exodus from Egypt or the exile from Jerusalem. Esther repeats this word, exile, again and again for a single reason. This is Mordecai's history, his family's story. This is who he is, and nothing about that changes. Whether Nebuchadnezzar is king, or Cyrus, or Darius, or Xerxes, they're on the fourth king now. You see, when you find your identity within yourself, when you figure out who you are as an individual, it's kind of like living your life as a tiny stone, just waiting for someone to pick you up and toss you, and then pick you up and toss you again, and then toss you again. There is no weight to your life. Everything that happens to you will move you, will carry you along, will cause anxiety, will draw a reaction out of you. But if you are not a tiny pebble, if you are instead part of a giant boulder, a family spanning generations, a family founded in the one true God of the universe, then waves can fall on you, kids can climb on you, cars can crash into you, kingdoms can rise and fall, and there you are, unmoved. Mordecai is a rock throughout Esther. Not because Mordecai is a superhero, but because Mordecai is part of a people claimed by God. God's people will not be moved. Mordecai might have a Persian name, but Mordecai is not a Persian man. He is a Jew. He lives out of this identity, never a sense that he is owed anything by Persia. Mordecai knows that he is not a Persian. Even at the very end of the story, when Mordecai has, against all odds, become second in command over Persia, two interesting things happen. First, because of Mordecai, the Jews, his own people, are said to have light and gladness and joy and honor. And these are people who were just on the verge of death. Mordecai seeks the welfare of his people. And the second thing that happens as a result of what Mordecai does for his people, for the Jews, people from all over the world want to become Jewish. Notice they don't want to become Persian. Mordecai is the second in command in Persia, and he's essentially a nobody among the Jewish people. He has no rank or status. He's not a religious leader. And yet, Mordecai, as a Jew, he is apparently distinct enough in both his character and his actions that people see him and they identify him as Jewish, not as a Persian. And they want what he has. I said this last week, but I need to say it again. We are not at home here. Both Peter and James, Jesus' disciples, tell us we are a dispersed people scattered throughout the world, foreigners exiled from the Garden of Eden. We are exiles. Eden is the home that our hearts long for. It doesn't matter what your passport says or what rights you have been assured through a constitution. Tomorrow, all of that could be gone. Through an election, through a revolution, through an invasion, or some other cause, your American citizenship has always been on shaky ground. Nations come and go. Persia was first, and next is us. But in a world where kingdoms and nations are never guaranteed, you know what is guaranteed? What is promised? This one thing. Jesus Christ is Lord. No matter who is king or president or mayor or school board, Jesus is Lord and he is with us right now. He reigns over a kingdom. A kingdom that we have been invited to join. We have been offered citizenship in a kingdom that is not of this world. And yet, here we are in a place scattered through every nation, living in foreign countries, doing the work of our one true King. This is our calling. We are living, breathing ambassadors of our King and his kingdom. And we show people what our King is like, what his kingdom is like, in all of the ways that we love and are present to our neighbors. And especially when we are a non-anxious presence. When we are not thrown around by everything that happens in the news, but we maintain a stability. Our people will see us and they see that we worship a different king and our home is in another kingdom. Do you today find yourself first and foremost living as a citizen of the kingdom of God? When your neighbors look at your life, at your character, at your priorities, do they see an American or do they see a citizen of the kingdom of God? Do they see you and want to become a citizen of this kingdom? When America fades into the sunset, like every other nation, you know, at least you've heard, Jesus says, that nothing, not tribulation or distress, persecution or famine, nakedness or danger or the sword can shake God's kingdom of love. Not death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all of creation can shake God's kingdom of love. Mordecai lived with this sort of conviction about his God. It allowed him to live at peace when almost everything else was out of his control. It allowed him to live with courage when there was something good he could do. Mordecai shows us how to live as dispersed people who abide deeply in their God. We can have peace, living patient and virtuous lives, if we would just resist the urge to make ourselves at home here. if we could simply accept the reality that we cannot change the world, then we might get less upset when we fail to change the world, or when an election seems to undo the change we thought we brought to the world. Let me finish with this quote from theologian Stanley Hauerwas. The first task of the church is not to make the world more just, but to make the world the world. This is how we live as a non-anxious presence in the world, abiding deeply in Jesus, who is the head of the church.